Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's my very pleasant duty as director of the London School of Economics to welcome you to this lecture theatre, which has, in its day, had a number of extremely distinguished politicians here to address the students and the public. But I don't think we've ever had quite such a lineup as we have this afternoon. It's my very pleasant duty to welcome Herr Schmidt, Monsieur Valéry d'Estaing, and of course Sir Edward Heath, who are here both at our invitation and with the help of the Charlemagne Trust, a trust founded by some of our alumni, and devoted, as I hope you will have discovered from the handouts on your seat, to stimulating debate over on the European Union. And we are here to debate this afternoon how we can make the European Union work. And I do hope, in fact, as chairman, I will insist that we keep the debate to that subject. There are doubtless questions that you might like to ask our guests outside that topic, but for this afternoon, it's how we make the European Union work. I will be asking each of our guests in sequence to speak for between 10 and 15 minutes so that we are aware and understand where they come from and what their position is. And then I will throw the debate open to the floor and invite questions. And I'd be very grateful, I'll remind you of this, I'd be very grateful if when you ask a question, you could say who you are, because we're recording the proceedings, and otherwise it's very difficult to track who said what to whom and when. And please, I'd be grateful too, for obvious reasons, if when you ask your question, you could keep it as brief as possible and to the point. But now, no more from me. Herr Schmidt, can I invite you to begin?
I hope you will permit me to speak sitting. How does one lower this thing here?
I think probably like that.
A practical economist.
They're very rare.
That's what I was going to say. But I must mention then that I'm an economist myself. Well, I would like to start out by reminding you of the famous great speech of Winston Churchill in Zurich in 1946, when he invited the French to stretch out their hands and reconciliate with the Germans, which the French did 4 years later under the spiritual leadership of Jean Monnet, Robert Schuman, and others later on followed that same path. The motivations for Churchill were twofold. On the one hand, to build a barrier, a roadblock against further Soviet and communist expansion. This right now is not so important. And the other main motive was that he did foresee the economic and political revival of Germany, even if it would take some time, and he wanted to bind Germany into a greater entity. And this motive is prevailing still, not only on the side of our French neighbors, also on the side of the Germans, and still it's the main motive for somebody like myself to advocate the European Monetary Union, one currency and one central bank system. Why is it? You know, if we look back onto the history of continental Europe, when the Germans were weak, Germany was invaded by the Turks, by the Asian hordes on horseback, by the Swedes, by the French under Louis XIV, under Napoleon again. When the Germans were strong, they invaded others. Last time, almost anybody in Europe under Adolf Hitler. Now that Germany has become unified, Germany is a little bigger in as regards population. If you look onto the 80 million Germans today, or 82 million, and you are a Pole, it's bigger than 2 times Poland. It is about 8 times the Czechish Republic, more than 5 times the Netherlands, and even 1.5 times almost the size of the French population or the British or the Italian. And if you are not so much interested in population figures, look at the currencies. I have the feeling that if no common currency is being created, no one central bank system in the European Union is being created, then it seems rather likely that we are running into a situation in which in 10, 15 years' time, namely when we Germans have overcome the difficulties of integrating East Germany economically, that within 10 or 15 years' time, Deutschmark will dominate the continent, which means German financial institutions, not only the Bundesbank, but also the Bundesbank, but particularly private banks, insurance, trusts, what have you, reinsurance, may dominate the continent, which is something which has to be avoided. The Germans are wanting to bind themselves into the European Union because they do not want the same thing to happen which has happened twice in this century, namely that almost all their neighbors coalesced against the Germans. Hitler enforced that kind of a coalition. Anybody in Europe was against Hitler. Was a grand coalition, even including the Russians or Soviets, as they were called at the time. I would like to prevent a similar situation to happen again, let me say, only in the field of finance, which would then easily spread over into the political fields. Germany must not be left alone. I have the feeling that the 4 predecessors that I had in office and my successor, Helmut Kohl, all the 6 of us, have in the main operated on these insights and on these concepts. And also do I have the feeling that my French neighbors, more or less, some more and some less, have operated along the same lines because of the motivation, of the motive, strategic principle, if you will call it such, to bind Germany, to integrate Germany into a greater entity. This also, from my point of view, was the reason for President Giscard d'Estaing and myself in the late 70s to create what then was called the European Monetary System. You British always have preferred to refer to it as the exchange rate mechanism. Sounds a little bit less threatening to British ears, I understand. But we meant a union, a European Monetary Union, and we hoped that out of this monetary union, a real monetary union later on would be developed. It was a group of currencies that were linked together by fixed exchange rates, but these exchange rates were adjustable, and they have been adjusted a number of times by consensus between the governments and the central banks. Sometimes Deutschmark was appreciated, and sometimes other currencies were depreciated, but we maintained the system of fixed rates, which we thought was all the more necessary since the worldwide system of fixed exchange rates had broken down to due to American desires in the early 70s when they pulled the rug out from under the feet of the Bretton Woods institutions. I remember very well in the first 15 years after the war, we had to pay 4 Deutschmarks for $1. Then it trickled downward. After 1972, 73, the dollar very quickly sank down to 1 mark 72. For psychological, political reasons, for a short while, it got up a little later. Again, under the stewardship of Ronald Reagan. But now then it went down again, and nowadays it stands around 1.47. It already, 47 or so. It already was down to 1.40. And if I have the right feeling for the future fiscal and monetary policy in the United States, which, by the way, right now and since years already and for the oncoming future as well, is and will be the greatest net importer of foreign capital. A country that lives partially on other nations' savings. That I have the feeling that the dollar will even go down further in the oncoming future, let us say at least over the next 10 years. They will not be able to do away with their huge budgetary deficits and quite impressive trade deficits and what have you. Now, if you look onto the situation of the common market from not so much from a German angle of view, but from a more community angle, I must tell you that a common market with 13 currency, the word common market is a misnomer. It's a very uncommon market. Even in Moscow or in Marrakesh, you just have three currencies in one market. The transaction costs alone within the common market, as long as we were 12 members, are at about 30 billion Deutschmark or $20 billion per year. But what's even more important is the necessity of hedging within that common market against your competitor. And this hedging business, which never played a great role as long as the Bretton Woods institutions were working, has mushroomed in the meantime. We have are seeing a wave of speculationism in the first place, starting in the United States, not only in the field of currencies, but also in the field of currencies, also in the field of shares. You will remember this wave of speculative, unfriendly takeovers. You will remember the junk bonds, and nowadays you have derivatives markets. I'm not referring to a Barings Bank, but I would just go to say that as far as I can judge in listening to bankers, members of the boards of the biggest banks in New York and Frankfurt and in your country and in Tokyo, out of 12 members of a board, hardly two do understand what their bank is doing in this field. And the other have just to trust, which they did in the case of Barings, and they were mistaken, and governments also may be deadly mistaken sometime in the future. Governments were mistaken when they did not see the mistakes that the big banks made in giving loans to Latin America. You will remember the Latin American debt crisis. You will remember the Mexican crisis. You did see that banks were handing out loans on the basis of the value of real estate or stock, which was enormously overvalued. You have such a case nowadays in Tokyo, where of 10 big banks, 10, all each and all of them are in difficulties because the basis of their loans has depreciated by about 50%. Market value of stocks or market value of real estate being just one half of what it had been when the loan was done. All this speculationism that has overflooded the world in the last 20 years seems very dangerous to me. You cannot exclude domino effects. You can, of course, rescue some 449 savings and loans associations by taxpayers' money. This is thinkable and has been done in the United States. The Japanese have just started to rescue savings and loans unions, but to save the big banks from big nonsense may become unsurmountable. This is also a reason why I would like to have a central bank inside the common market. Of course, I do understand that the British will not join. You will come later. You can rest assured, you will come later, like you did with the European European integration as a whole. Let me, as a person, say that I was advocating Britain's entry into the European Economic Community, as it was called in the late 50s and in the 60s. I have been advocating that since I first had learned to know Jean Monnet, that is, since 1948. And I was a member of parliament since 1953. I have advocated your entry in your own country, particularly vis-a-vis the Labour Party. And in 1957, when the Treaty of Rome was up for ratification in the German parliament, I abstained because I thought it was a mistake to start the whole thing without the British. But now I have understood that I was mistaken and that it would even have been better if the Brits had been staying out a little longer than they really did. Because in the meantime, you are somebody who puts his foot onto the brakes every once in a month or in a quarter of a year, at least in a quarter of a year. And you will do so as well as regards the monetary union. You will come later on. And this has some to do with your insular instincts, has some to do with the classical role balancing the powers of Europe in the 19th century and having tried to maintain that policy, that strategy also in the first half of this century and even in the second half. What you will have to understand is that Britain as a national economy, or sterling as a national currency, or the Netherlands as a national economy and the guilder as a florin as a national currency, or Germany as an economy and Deutschmark, we are just too small to stand up against the real great economic powers that do exist or are in the making. Real great economic powers like the United States in the future, United States plus Canada plus Mexico, or Japan, or China. Vietnam is coming up. Vietnam will very quickly be one of the so-called little tigers, the former little tigers, in the meantime having grown up to real tigers. And our separated European economies are just too small, and so are our currencies. And we are already much too dependent on the volatilities in Washington and on the volatilities also in Tokyo and perhaps in the future as well in Beijing or maybe Shanghai. Now, I have the feeling I've used up my time. Thank you. I would just like to repeat one sentence. If we don't get a common currency, which I see to come in the first decade, beginning of the first decade of the next century, maybe not in the 90s, but in the 2002, 2003 or so. If we do not get it, then you will get something which is much more unpalatable to you and to me than the present situation, namely a dominating Deutschmark. Thank you very much.
And now, Monsieur Giscard d'Estaing.
Well, thank you. First, I wish to tell you how happy I am to speak in a theater. Because in a famous dialogue by Plato, Plato said that there is a sort of similarity between politicians, actors, and priests, because all of them are trying to address an audience and to convey to this audience what they feel or what they believe. So I will do my best for that. I will do it in English. I don't understand why. No. Because we are trying in France to make the French people bilingual by education. And I hope that in Britain and here in the London School of Economics, you are doing the same effort. But since it's not achieved up to now, I will speak in my poor English on the subject we were supposed to address, how to make the European Union work. In the next 5 years, which is a short time in terms of history, we will have to address three main issues. First, the enlargement. Second, how to organize the existing European Union. And the third, how to make or not a new step forward, that is the monetary union. The first point is a subproduct of the German unification and the collapse of the Soviet Union system. Until 1989, we were building, in fact, a Western European Union. This was not very easy, it was underway. But the goal was to achieve a sort of close relationship with strong institutions between the Western European countries. As Helmut mentioned, I would say Helmut Schmidt, it's more, excuse me.
It's okay.
Yeah. As Helmut mentioned, the initial purpose was to unify the classical Western continental countries. When Robert Schuman sent his first letter to propose the beginning of the process, he sent it to Britain also. But at that time, the British government declined. So we had this building of the common market and the Rome Treaty, and then some enlargement, mainly with Great Britain, of course, due to the historical position taken by Sir Edward Heath. And until the German unification, we had a system in which the group of countries involved wanted to go ahead toward a sort of integrated system, with some countries wanting to go slower, mainly the UK and to some extent Denmark. But then we have a clear majority out of 12 of 8-9 countries who wanted to go further. And so we had at that time sort of concept of Europe with two speeds. All the countries were in the system. Some wanted to go faster than the other, but the other countries will join one day or another. This has been changed. Because of the collapse of the Soviet Union system and the German unification, the political basis of the problem have been deeply altered. And if you don't understand this, the thinking or the studies about the future of European Union are confused. Of course, when there was the German unification, if there has been at that time very strong historical leaders, they would probably have tried to have at the same time the German unification process and the achievement of the European political union in a very short time. I think it could have been proposed at that time to Germany and probably to the rest of Europe. But that was not the course that has been chosen. We had the German unification made by the Germans alone with an enormous cost and very brilliant results. And then a process, slow process of European unification and enlargement. And the option has been taken, it's useless to go back on this, to accept all the new candidates. It means that in the next 5 years, about 5 years, the European Union will count around 25 or 27 member states with varied historical background, culture, level of economic development, diplomatic tradition, and all that. So it means we are in another, we are facing another problem, which is not to unify, integrate a small group of countries with similar background, but how to organize a large group of countries with different historical background. So the first task to make the European Union work will be in the next years a very practical one. How to organize this large group of countries, 25, 27, into an efficient, democratic, and more or less organized political ensemble. And this will be the task of what is called the Intergovernmental Conference of 96-97. This conference is not a conference like in the past, how to go on with the process of European integration. Because the large Europe is not adapted to the progress of European integration. You cannot integrate countries from the Western Europe, from the Balkans, from the Mediterranean countries into a really tight political unit. You have to organize this large Europe. And so this will be the task of the next conference, 96-98. It's a very difficult task because you have to change the rule of voting. You have to change the question of how the parliament works because it will have an enormous number of members, a balance of representation which will be not fair between the large countries and the small countries, and the process will remain a very complicated and difficult one. And we'll have also the question of how to represent this group vis-à-vis the rest of the world. For instance, at the moment, it is the president of the Spanish government who is touring the world in the name of the European Union. He's a very good man, political man, but everyone knows that in 1 month and a half it will be finished for him, for his presidency. And the next one will be Italy. And who will be the chairman in the name of Europe in the next 6 months? So all these problems, which are practical problems, should be addressed in the coming negotiations. If this negotiation succeeds, it will reach limited results. Anyway, because it's not possible with the differences between large countries and small countries, countries who want to have an integrated Europe and countries who refused it or who are not ready at the moment to accept it, to make a very significant step forward. So the last problem we will have to address in the 5 minutes which are left to me, to make the European Union work, is to know if some countries want to do more. And my hope and wish is that some countries will not be satisfied with it, because this large Europe will be not very much integrated, will have no political existence vis-à-vis the rest of the world, and we'll have not what we were dreaming for, that is a sort of political common base. But some countries are wanting to do it, mainly Germany, France, the Benelux countries, and in terms of public opinion, Spain and Italy, and some others are doubting or looking. So what to do? It's not possible to have this idea, you know, of a hardcore Europe, which was the idea of the two-speed Europe, because the difference is not a question of speed. It's a question of political design. Do you want to be a member of it or not? It's a choice. It's not a question of speed. So this group of countries will have to take a major decision before the end of the century about the monetary union. Because the monetary union is, of course, a financial and monetary problem, but it's mostly a political one. The fact to change D-mark, French franc, or other currencies against a new currency, it's a major political decision. And even if it's well prepared, and at the moment the preparation is doing well, the decision, the final decision, will be a political decision. And about this political decision, I would say just a few words. First, it's very clear that the countries which will be linked by a single currency will need to have some common institutions. You cannot have just a currency without some political support. Just for one practical reason, in the modern world, you cannot have a single monetary policy without converging economic policies, and permanently converging economic policies. And this will need an additional agreement, not a Maastricht agreement, a new one, between the countries that will join the monetary union to create the mechanisms that will assure the fact that for the future, they will keep converging economic policies. And if you have a joint monetary policy, if you have identical economic policies, you need to have some sort of political structure to address these issues. It cannot be left to the technostructure or to the technicians. It needs to have some political support. So the monetary union cannot be remain isolated. It will have some political complement. I will not enter into detail, but if there are questions, I will answer this question. Then we'll need to have a real negotiations with Great Britain. Because my expectation, like Helmut, is that Great Britain finally will not join. The choice of the British government of that time, or the British people, will probably be not to join, probably. But we cannot ignore this. And we need to have a real exploration of the situation we will then face. Because Europe needs to have some British form of participation. And if we are building the monetary union without Britain, this will suppose some sort of special negotiation with Britain to organize our future relationship. My last comment is in Britain, people ask you, do you think that monetary union will, in fact, succeed? First, I personally believe that the number of countries that will meet the criterions will be sufficient. Germany will be in this position, probably all the Benelux countries with a special problem from Belgium because of the indebtedness, but they will probably address this. France will be in position to join. Of course, it supposes some appropriate economic and fiscal policies, but my expectation is that they will be pursued until 98. The other aspect is we must start preparing for this now, because we only have 3 years from 96, 97, 98. And just to create the currency, the support of the currency, the banknotes and all this, to organize the changes in the accounting system, in the all the informatic processes of banking, of insurance, reinsurance and all this, we need 3 years of time. So we must start really soon to be able to meet the deadline of 99. And my personal hope and wish is that we will have a final decision before the end of the century, even if there are some delay for some technical aspects. And this decision will be interpreted by people and by historians as the final success or the final failure of the tentative started in the 50s to to create something new in Europe, of a new entity, as we dreamed, as you joined us, and as I personally hope we will finally succeed in building it.
And now, Sir Edward.
I would like to join with our chairman in welcoming our two most distinguished guests here today, and their contributions have already proved to be invaluable. Nothing that I could say, here or elsewhere, would be treated with such reverence as what we have already heard this afternoon. They must have brought home to you the extraordinary skepticism in the two other major countries of the European Union about British intentions or British wishes. And I hope they have also brought home to you the consequences of that skepticism. We have already, of course, seen examples in the recent meetings of heads of government attended by the British Prime Minister, in which he tried to alter the rules of the existing Union, but couldn't get a single other country to support him in so doing, and so he was humiliated. And we have had other examples that when Sterling, the speculators got a Sterling, it collapsed. And whereas the Bundesbank would support the French, we went down the drain because we hadn't got any friends in the Union who could help us. It really is time that we in this country realized what this situation is, and especially those who share the present Prime Minister's opening statement when he took office, that Britain must be at the heart of Europe. I fully support that. Some of you may have heard my views before, and they remain the same, that this is where we must be. And it has become more obvious since the collapse of the Soviet Union. We no longer have a two-superpower world. We have a five-power world. We have the United States finding it very difficult to adjust itself, and still going on expecting to tell the rest of the world what it must do. We have the Soviet Union economically in a state of collapse, but militarily, as they're now beginning to indicate over Yugoslavia, very powerful. We have China, 1.25 billion people, expanding at the rate of 12.5% a year, who aren't going to be told what they've got to do, not even by leaders. And we have and we have Japan, a foremost economic power, and then we have the European Union. And we, the British, can't have any influence on this new world that is going to develop unless we are at the heart of Europe and the European Union. I must confess that I found the title of this discussion, How to Make Europe Work, somewhat puzzling. How to make Europe work. Well, I was born in the First World War. I was a student when it was absolutely clear that the Second World War was going to come. And after the Third World War, after the Second World War, we determined to prevent, do our utmost to prevent a Third World War. That's what my generation has been about. And the European Union was the way to do it. The European Union is the greatest success story of the post-war world, without any doubt whatever. When I think of fighting across Europe, right up into Germany, and the devastation which one saw, people living in holes in the ground with no food or proper housing, mile after mile of it. That was only 50 years ago. And now we see Europe today. It's extraordinary prosperity, the conditions of its people, all of this in less than half a century in which the European Union has played the major part. That's why it's a success story. And the rest of the world realizes it. And the question now is not how to make it work, but how to enable it to develop further towards its final state. And here I want to deal with certain aspects, and with one of them I'm in disagreement with what Mr. Gisias Dessens just said. It is always said we have to deepen or we have to widen. And in this country, the emphasis is always on widen, which arouses everybody's suspicions. What are we trying to do? Well, we're trying to turn the European Union into an old European free trade area. That's what they think. And that's what a lot of people here want to do. Let's be quite blunt about it. And some book has just been written by some fellow hitherto unknown who accuses me of having wrecked the European Free Trade Association. Well, he was only age one when the community was established, and he was only nine when EFTA was set up, and he was only 11 when EFTA decided to join the European Union. So he doesn't know what he's talking about. And it's extraordinary that newspapers, supposedly respectable like the Times, should give so much attention to it. But this is the immediate reaction. This is what the British want to do, to turn it into just a free trade area. And Europe won't accept it. They won't accept that for a moment, as we've just heard from President Giscard. And so we shall be outside. And that has got to be stopped at all costs. One can then say, what about the widening? I don't believe it's rational, practical, sensible to say the European Union at this stage can be widened. Look at these countries in the East. Some of them, Bulgaria, Romania, they've got a standard of living only 20% of ours. How long is it going to take them to get anywhere near us? And all the time we're moving still further ahead. For heaven's sake, let's be realistic about this and stop talking about bringing all our brothers and sisters in with us in the next couple of years. No, it's going to take time. We help them very well, technologically, financially, materially, and we can show them that we want them eventually to be in a position in which they can join. But to talk now about it, I find absolutely unrealistic. And so the essential thing is to deepen. And here I wanted to just mention one aspect which has not been dealt with at the moment very fully, and that is to have a common foreign policy and a common defense policy. If we had had a common foreign policy in the Union, I do not believe the tragedies of Yugoslavia would have occurred. Not for one moment. And it would not have been possible for the Germans to step forward and recognize one of these countries, hence leading on to this ghastly war. We have got to have a common foreign policy. And as far as defense is concerned, we can't go on affording masses on defense, trying to prove we're still the world power. Of course we can't. And when one hears colleagues talking about massive reductions in taxation, how is it going to be brought about except by sacrificing the other things which we ought not to sacrifice in the modern world? So we need both common foreign policy and defense policy as soon as possible. And when I hear our former foreign secretary, who is now being satisfactorily remunerated, that of course, we can't have these things connected with the European Union. No, no, not for a moment. We can try to get them separately. Well, it's madness. It's like saying, yes, here in this country, we'll have finance and taxation in Whitehall. Foreign policy, dear me. Well, we better put all that up in Liverpool because that's outward looking. Let's have and defense policy, we mustn't get that near foreign policy or finance. No, no, send that up to Edinburgh. The Scots have always liked wars and they can carry on in their current situations. It makes no sense whatever. It's got to be a European Union which deals not only with economics and finance but also with foreign policy and with defense. Now, in the moment I've got left, this question of the economy and the single currency. The situation in this country is shown very clearly by the public opinion polls, which show that 82% of all our business world wants a single currency at the earliest possible moment. When you get to public opinion, 33% wants a single currency. Now this is an enormous gap. The explanation is clear that nobody has done anything to explain to the general public what it is all about and what has to be taken into account. And that's the weakness of the government, it's the weakness of members of parliament, it's the weakness of academics, and above all, it's the weakness of the press. So, as far as the single currency is concerned, my views are that it's got to come, and the quicker we have it, the better. Now, why has it got to come? Because we've got a single market, which we've heard quite rightly from Helmut, and it's of vital importance to us. You cannot keep a single market unless you get a single currency. There is no example in the world of a single market which has more than one currency. And the reason is very clear, that if a country or a province gets into difficulties, what will it do? It'll change its currency. That's what we did on Black Wednesday, change the currency. And then as soon as countries start changing their currencies to meet their difficulties, the rest of them will become protectionist again. They say we've got to protect ourselves against these developments. And once you get protectionism, you've lost the single market. That is the argument. And businessmen realize it. The others that, of course, instead of having to send out 15 different sorts of invoices, you only have to send one. Instead of having to insure against changes in currency on an invoice, you don't have to insure. You save money both ways. You can then reduce the cost to the consumer and to your exporter. All these are practical advantages. But perhaps the biggest is that we would have a strong currency with 350 million people if they were all in, and the speculators wouldn't then dare to attack us as they've done in the past. It would be a strong currency which could hold its own. And that's vital for the whole of Europe. Now, of course, we get the emotional aspects of it here, but what will happen to the Queen's head and so on? Well, Queen has kept her head in very difficult circumstances. And we have 7 royal families in the Union. We shall have at least 7 coins in a common currency, and you can have a royal head on each one of them. And it's not beyond human ingenuity to have one larger one and put all 7 heads round the outside. But the one thing which I must say is nonsense is to talk about having a referendum on all of this, with great respect also to the French system. Well, it is constitutional. We don't, thank God, yet have it as constitutional, for very sound reasons that Parliament must decide. But what's going to happen to the existing currency if you spend 4 weeks tramping up and down the country, trying to persuade people one way or the other to have a single currency or not have a single currency? Public opinion poll comes out, they're going to have a single currency. What do the speculators do? Up they go. Next public opinion poll says, no, they're now against a single currency. What are the speculators going to do? It's talking nonsense to say, let's have a national referendum of whether or not we're going to have a single currency. And that, too, we've got to bring home to people. And so these are the factors which I think are absolutely crucial on the single currency. And the fact is, Helmut talked about EMS. I remember very well, I don't know whether he does, that we spent almost a day at Aswan on the Nile discussing these questions. And I urged him that we must have a European, what became the EMS. I wasn't sure I persuaded him, but it emerged later that I had, because he strongly wanted the European monetary system. But he was politically and economically very clever, because he persuaded the French to put the proposal forward, which they did. So this was a joint action. And we shall see many more of them. We were outside. But if, in 1985, we had gone for the EMS at the existing rate of exchange, we would never have had Black Wednesday, because they were exactly the same as they are today. Those were our exchange rates, dollar and mark. And it was only because the then Prime Minister, whose name I don't mention, insisted on pushing the pound further and further and further up, saying, look what a wonderful pound we've got. And of course, it was artificial, and it ended in disaster. Well, these are some of the factors which I think we've got to consider in the future. But my objective will be still the same. We must persuade the British people to play their full part in Europe. And I hope at the end that our 2 guests today will come to the conclusion that we are just a shade better than they've indicated.
Well, I don't think we could have had 3 clearer or franker or more emphatic statements of view than that. And the rest of this hour is now up to you. Can I just remind you that since we'll be recording this discussion, it would help us enormously if you were to say who you are before you ask your question, and if you could keep that question short, concise, and to the point, we'd all be very grateful. And to spare your embarrassment, could I ask David Marsh, whom I've told before, at the beginning of this, that I was going to ask him the first question. I don't have a second, so if you could catch my eye by putting your hand up, I'd be grateful. Oh, that's right. I mean, could I ask David Marsh to ask the first question?
Have they got microphones they can use?
No, but I think we'll be able to hear, and since Herr Schmitz is not doesn't hear very well, I will amplify in his ear.
Well, number one, we would certainly not hold a referendum in Germany. And therefore, what the people today think, which, by the way, may differ from what they think next Monday, more or less depending on the media, doesn't matter so much. What does matter is what the political class is thinking. And they are fairly united on this matter. As regards the Bundesbank, you are right in hinting to some critical view that you have rather moderately put forward here. You know, the Bundesbank is in the situation as any other bureaucracy. They have enjoyed almost total independence. The only exception is they cannot fix their own income, but otherwise, I mean personal income. But otherwise they are really independent, and now they should turn themselves into an affiliate organization of a European Central Bank, and they dislike that. No bureaucrat of what country soever would like to get somebody on top of himself that formerly did not exist there. This is the main motivation. They would, of course, deny what I said there. That's their good right. The Bundesbank will not have any say in the political decision. This is a matter for the government to decide and a matter for the Bundestag, the German parliament, to decide. And there's no doubt that in the Bundestag you will get a majority of at least 85%.
Sir.
My name is Percy Gorgi. I'm an alumnus of the LSE. President Giscard said that the monetary union would require political structure. Now this goes to the heart of the vexed question of sovereignty, of national sovereignty. How is this to be solved? Is there one way of doing it by allocating powers to the center and specifically, and those that are not mentioned will reside with the national parliaments and the national governments? And may I ask Sir Edward if he can comment on the foreign common foreign policy and defense policy and its possible impact on NATO and our American allies.
Monsieur Destin?
Yes. What I said is a very obvious and practical point. First, as Helmut mentioned, we don't need additional decision to make the monetary union. The decision has been taken.
In the Maastricht Treaty.
It is in the Maastricht Treaty. And on January 1st, 1999, all the countries which will meet the criterion will enter the monetary union and have fixed exchange rates starting January 1st. So there's not additional decision. Some countries have hinted that they could consult public opinion or parliament, but even the debate in the Bundestag or the debate in the French parliament cannot change the commitment. If we have, in starting then, a single monetary policy, it's very clear that we need to have converging economic policies. And the process, which is described in the Maastricht Treaty, is going until the beginning of the monetary union, but it must go on. And so we will need to have some additional political convergence to make this situation permanent. The chairman of the Bundestag, with whom I discussed this point a few days ago with you, also Helmut, suggested, for instance, that in the Maastricht Treaty, if a country doesn't respect the 3%, for instance, GNP limit for public deficit, it can, one can impose on him penalties, fines, limitation of the support of the European institutions and all that. But it needs a positive vote. We can agree between the countries who will be member of the monetary union. We can agree on the reverse, that if a country doesn't meet the criterion after 1999, then automatically the consequences will be applied to it. And we will need a negative vote to change this. So I just mentioned this to tell you that certainly around 1998 there will be additional proposals to enforce the economic convergence. And at that time, I will, for instance, going along with Edward Heath's suggestion, I will, or some other, will propose that we go further into the question of defense. Because there is a linkage between the economic policy, the cost of defense, or the risk you take in terms of defense. And why not, at that time, decide what we did in the 50s when we decided to pool the coal and steel industries. Why not decide then to have a common defense budget between the countries joining the monetary union? To have an absolute sharing of the defense costs and also a mechanism which will lead us to have a permanent common defense policy. Then you have, as you mentioned, the question of democratic expression on this. I think that normally an increasing role will be given then to the national parliaments. Because for economic policies, fiscal policies, and defense policy, the national parliaments cannot be ignored. So probably we will have the European Parliament for the large Europe. But for the countries of the monetary union, we can use a new approach and having, for instance, the permanent commissions of the British House of Commons, of the Bundestag, of the other countries, having regular meetings together to follow up the development of the common economic, monetary, and defense policies.
So, Edward, would you like to address the point about NATO?
Yes, I think that there's got to be a lot of fresh thought about all of this. NATO is there for a specific purpose. There are some who will say, I think with conviction, that nobody will know at this moment how Russia is going to develop. If Yeltsin trips again when he's getting off an aeroplane, then a replacement may be necessary. And who will it be? And will the army then step in and take over all these possibilities? And so it is arguable one should keep a form of NATO. On the other hand, I don't accept we've got to go around the world looking for things for NATO to do. That I strongly object to. And who knows what the outcome of these operations in Yugoslavia is going to be. There's a lot of doubt about them at the moment. And as far as transatlantic relations are concerned, well, then the European Union can establish transatlantic relations perfectly well, as we will have to do with the People's Republic of China or Japan or anywhere else. Again, some of you will know that when President Nixon greeted me on the lawn of the White House, we each made a friendly speech, and I said there's no such thing as a special relationship between Britain and America. And it's very insulting to say to the Americans, of course, you mustn't do this with the Germans or that with the Mexicans, because the special relationship is with us. And it's very insulting to the rest of them, our friends and colleagues, to say, well, you mustn't have this with the Americans because we've got the special relationship. This has led to a large amount of misunderstanding. And so the Union creates a relationship with the United States where we have common interests, well and good, and where we don't, then in the usual way we shall have to argue them out. There was this question about sovereignty. Well, the fact is that the community started with supranational arrangements to deal with steel and coal, which were necessary to make the first weapons of war. And when people say to me, we can't have anything to do with supranationality, we've got it, and the community's always had it. And as we are all pooling our sovereignty, I don't see that that can be condemned either. The fact is that sovereignty exists to be used for the benefit of the people. And is this a project which is for the benefit of our people? And if it is, then we should use it. And all the others who are members use it as well. Sovereignty isn't something you put down in the cellar like you do your gold reserves and go with the candle once a week, see if it's still there. Of course not. The thing is that you use it. In this case, we can use it, I believe, for the benefit of our people. And so that's my answer to this perpetual question of sovereignty. Can I just make one point about structure, which I think supplements and is important? Jean Monnet's conception, with help of friends, was a brilliant piece of foresight. But there was one thing which was missing. He established the ministerial meetings under the foreign secretary. He established the commission, not just like Whitehall to do what the party in power tells them after looking at the manifesto, but to come forward with solutions to the problems. They had to be approved by the ministers. Very well. Then the other thing was the European Parliament, which has gradually grown, and then the European Court of Justice. But he didn't have anything for heads of government to do. And that didn't start until in 1972, the then French president called the first meeting of heads of government. And there were very good Europeans who said, what on earth are you doing? You don't appear in any of the treaties, and therefore you don't exist. And so how can you have a conference in Paris to discuss all of these things if you don't exist? Well, President Pompidou didn't accept that as an argument, and we had the first ministerial meeting. And now they meet once every 6 months. Well, now the British cabinet meets twice a week. French cabinet meets once a week. How can they possibly meet once every 6 months and take decisions affecting 350 million people? This is the gap at the moment, and it's got to be filled. And we can work out and argue how it can be filled. And we mustn't take any notice of the people who say, oh, this is a confederation or non-federation or something or other. It puzzles again everybody in the world. The British gave confederation to Canada. They gave it to Australia. They gave it to South Africa. They gave it to Central Africa. They gave it to the Caribbean. And after the war, they gave it to Germany. But we mustn't be involved. It's not quite nice for us. Now, this has got to be killed, and we've got to have an impartial look at how to get the center alive, well, in existence, to deal with the continuous day-by-day and the other problems of the Union. And it's essential that we now get the best minds to work out constitutionally how that can be done.
Yes, sir. A European businessman. He's a Labour politician.
Particularly interested in the word work instead of making the European Union. I would very much like to hear the views of those on the fact regarding the present government's attitude towards social contract. And the need, the views of the
How important is the social contract?
Pardon?
How important is the social contract?
Would you like to start?
Chairman, can you repeat the question?
Yes. I'm sorry.
The questioner said he was a businessman who travels a lot in Europe, and he was particularly interested in the word work. And as a Labour Party supporter, he would like to hear the views of the panel on what I would interpret as saying the social contract and the social side of Europe. We've heard a lot about the economic, a lot about defence. What about the social aspects of Europe?
Do you want to embarrass me at the point? Well, I had many debates on this with Delors when he was chairman of the commission. There is a sort of ambiguity on this, because it's very understandable that if the European Union is an action for all people, it must have a social dimension. In every of our national states, we have a social policy of some sort. We try to improve social relations, social conditions of people, and all that. And we cannot have a Europe which will be limited to some purely abstract matters like money, currency, budget, and ignoring the social conditions of people. So on this, everyone must agree. What is difficult is what practical steps this leads you to. Of course, there are certain conditions that should be respected on the whole European Union concerning, for instance, protection vis-à-vis the accident du travail, the dangers of working, the conditions of labor for young people, for women, all that, to have a fair social competition in Europe. But the key point is the question of minimum social level. And this is very difficult because the differences are so high that if you put a minimum on a European level, it will be very low. If you have a European minimum wage, for instance, or if you have minimum social protections for aging people, it will be very low. So this debate has never been quite solved. And I think instead of having a formalized opposition between the countries who wants to go further and the country who refuse, it's better to have a very practical approach. What are the sort of progress, or social progress, we can agree in Europe, taking into account the differences that exist, and what are the progresses where we are not able for the moment to achieve?
Well, I must say I'm a little bit skeptical about equalizing anything in the same ridiculous way in which we have done it with agriculture. Costs a lot of money and leads to a situation where overproduction is the rule. Also, of course, protection. And the same could easily happen in the field of wages. Maybe I differ a little bit from you, Valerie, but let me say that economic convergence and also quite some part of social convergence will necessarily be enforced by the fact that there is only one and the same money supply. Because if, for instance, one country, maybe due to its great social insurance expenditure out of the budget, if one country carries heavy budgetary deficits, or in one country you have extraordinary wage increases in 1 year or in over a couple of years, these people will not be able to get the necessary financing from the central bank. And they will learn it the hard way. We have some examples in Germany more than 100 years ago. When Bismarck formed or refounded German Reich in 1871, the common currency was introduced 4 years later. By then, we certainly did not have a common economic policy in all of Germany, nor did we have a great central budget. They had their different budget policies. But if, for instance, Bavaria had gotten themselves into deficit and had to try and sell their loans on the financial markets, they would have, this is a theoretical example, they would have to offer higher interest rates if they wanted to sell their loans. And I'm not that optimistic about equalizing policies in any field. There is much too much bureaucratic equalizing right now. All of the people are told that Brussels is to be blamed. If you look closely onto the details of all these ridiculous regulations and directives which come out of Brussels every week, what you will find is that in the main do they stem from one or two or three of the national bureaucracies or the national governments who table their drafts in Brussels, and then the 13th bureaucracy, or nowadays the 16th bureaucracy, namely the Brussels one, also mingles into it, and then you get this banana directive or whatever it is. And this leads me to one remark which Ted Heath made, as a gap to be filled, you said. I'm disappointed, I must say, about the role of the parliament. They always complain that they don't have real power. And I always tell them, you would, for instance, have the power to organize public hearings in a committee, television present, and let Directive 27A, paragraph XYZ, appear as ridiculous as you can, and the commissioner who has to defend it will leave the room backwards and will not so soon reappear. I mean, they don't really play the role that they could. Formerly, they complained that they were appointed by national parliaments. Then the two of us have introduced the direct election of that parliament. They could play a much greater role if they had some more. What is the word?
Mood. Guts. Guts.
Guts, by the word, by the way, is the motto for the whole thing.
Sir Edward.
On this question of the social chapter, the British have opted out of it. I'm a natural heretic on this because I'm a conservative. And we have had, well, first of all, I wonder how many people in this hall can tell me what the contents of the social chapter are. No. Oh, there's one chap at the right at the top there. Perhaps we can meet afterwards. But this is the situation. And if you read the social chapter carefully, there is nothing there which we could take exception. It was a political move to show that the Prime Minister was standing up against these outrageous Europeans. And we've had in this country since 1909 a minimum wage introduced by Churchill, kept by every government of every colour and every coalition until 2 years ago when the present government abolished it. And when I was Minister of Labour, I celebrated the 50th anniversary of the minimum wage. Now, what is the argument against it? I don't want to go into them all, but one thing I do want to point out is that it doesn't improve efficiency. And there are many countries in the world which are more efficient than we are and have kept a minimum wage. What it does do is to give the employer every opportunity in times of unemployment to push down the wages of all his people. It doesn't make him more efficient, it enables him to avoid becoming more efficient because he gets the result by slashing the wages. And you can see it already happening in this country. I give an example which will be natural to everybody in this hall, and that is the pub. Go into a pub today, and I find in my locals that the barmen have gone. They've got kids. They can have them for two nights each week, pay them next to nothing, and so they carry on. That's what's happening. And that's a practical result. And as a historical conservative, I strongly object to it, and we should never have opted out.
There was a question. Yes, sir.
David Morgan, I'm a personal assistant to an MP in Parliament and a Labour candidate.
Did you hear that question? Well, the question asked, questioner asks, what would our guests think would be the impact on the United Kingdom of our not choosing to join the European Monetary Union in 10 or 15 years? And he explained he was himself an assistant to a member of the European Union Parliament and a Labour councillor. Mr. Smith.
In the monetary field, in 10 or 15 years, you will probably understand that you made a mistake and will join them. If you don't, you will join up with the American dollar. Sterling alone in the oncoming world of five world powers, as Ted Heath said, will not be able to overcome all the crises which you are bound to have to face.
My expectation is about the same. If there is a single European currency for the world, it will be the single currency for Europe. And all the traders in the world and all the quotations will be made in that new European currency. So all the other currencies of Europe will become second-class currency. And all the big companies, all the banking system, all the markets will be quoted into the new single European currency. So it means that, for instance, either the London market will adjust and adopt for practical purpose, the new European currency, or it will get a sort of fading away in the world system. And I guess, that the London market will adopt the single currency. And then you will have a strange situation in which all the quotations, all the real values in the world will be expressed, even in Britain, into the single European currency, and you will have a sort of local or provincial currency used for other purposes. And I don't think it will be a healthy situation for Britain, and I think that then, like Helmut forecast, probably then Britain will join.
Yes, I agree. If we're not in, there's no future. That's quite plain. It's our job to make it absolutely plain. I will confess, when I took Britain into the community in 1971, we negotiated. Obviously, we had thought about what the possibilities were and where we would lose out. And I firmly believed, as did most people hear, that when we got to the stage of a central monetary system, that it would be the City of London and the Bank of England, which would be foremost in all the arrangements. It's therefore for me a personal blow that we've lost all of that. I understand the reasons, but it's a great blow. One of the other things I thought was the British cars would then take over the European market, but that doesn't seem to have happened either.
Could I perhaps add, this questioner did ask what would the impact on the United Kingdom, and I think in 10 or 15 years' time, if there's a parliament in Edinburgh, the United Kingdom Parliament might decide one thing, but what the parliament in Edinburgh decided might be much more interesting. But now, question back here. Could you speak up? The questioner was quoting the German Minister of State at the Foreign Office, who apparently said that what Europe needs is more unity and less variety. What do the panelists think? Sir Edward, could we start with you?
Over me?
Yes.
Sorry. I don't often think about the ministers of the Foreign Office. That. The variety is there. It'll always be there. Exactly the same way in the United States, it's there. All the variety between New York and California and Wyoming and all the rest of them. You can't remove that. What you do is to work for unity of approach on policy, which affects the various activities of the Union. And that's required. If that's what he meant, then he was right. I'm very doubtful about what he meant.
You sure you got this time?
Yeah, I go back to my point. You cannot imagine that the large Europe will be a structure for unity. It's not possible, it's not realistic, because the differences between the countries, you mentioned this about the widening, are such that the level of unity will be extremely low if you try to build it at the level of the European continent. So if you want to have more unity, this unity can be reached only by the group of countries having two things in common: common historical and cultural traditions, and also and mainly common political goals. A few days ago, about a burning issue of the moment, the Prime Minister of Sweden said, but what do you speak about common defense policy? The common defense policy is not in the Maastricht Treaty. We're not interested in common defense policy. So why do you speak about it? So in the large Europe, you will have a very low level of unity. It's the reason for which I think we must organize for practical functioning the large Europe, but we must define together, and I hope with the British, one day, what our goal for achieving a higher degree of European unity.
I'm not sure whether I really understood the question, but I want to point out that whatever comes from these negotiations which my friend Giscard d'Estaing is referring to, let's hope that these negotiations lead to satisfying results. Nevertheless, even if only 15 members of the community today, they do have 12 different languages, and they will stick to their languages, and they will stick to their national identity. It's ridiculous to think that the French will give up their typical French national cultural heritage and identity. It's as ridiculous to believe that we would give up ours, and it's as ridiculous that the Brits always fear that their national identity is going through the roof or something. You tend, and this is sometimes also the case in my country, you tend to use traditional terms. If you talk about the European future, one hears words like federation or confederation. What we are aiming at and what we have been building up in the last 45 years since the Schuman Plan, is something totally new and different and does not fit into all the schemes which political science had developed formally.
Yes. The questioner was asking whether we this is a very simple yes-no question. The questioner asks whether it is the view of our panelists that we should have a common second language, given that all 15 nations are going to stick to their 12 separate languages. Should they not have a common European language as a second tongue which we would all speak? What do you think?
You have it already, and it is English.
Yeah.
I agree, that is the answer. There's just one point on what Helmut was saying, that the difference and so on. We have got an enormous amount in common in Europe. We've got a common European heritage. And when people talk about the English heritage or our heritage minister, it really doesn't make very much sense. And I've said to the present one, go get somebody to go around the museums. Now, how many works of art in the galleries today are in fact British? We've got them from all over Europe. Got them from the Italians, got them from the Germans, got them from the French, and here and there we've got a British Constable or Turner or somebody. The music, Bach, Beethoven, Brahms, all came from Germany. We give them a certain amount back in Purcell, Elgar. They don't make very much use of it. But more performances of Elgar's First Symphony were conducted in Germany than there were in this country. And this is all common. We don't have to worry about that.
Yes, at the back. Yes.
Morris Fraser, special advisor to the last 3 months. President,
if you could shout, it would help.
Yeah, President Giscard d'Estaing suggested that if a hardcore of countries go ahead with single currency, some special arrangement would need to be devised with the United Kingdom. I was wondering if the members of the panel might like to speculate as to the nature of that arrangement, particularly in the light of concern in some countries, notably France, that Britain and indeed Italy might be in a position to go on enjoying the benefits of the single market whilst running a highly competitive currency outside the single currency zone.
Did you all hear the question?
No.
Well, yes, okay.
You repeat it, please. For the people.
The questioner who says that he has been an advisor to a number of foreign secretaries recently asked whether the panel would care to speculate on the terms which might be negotiated if the United Kingdom did not join the European Monetary Union, because Monsieur Giscard d'Estaing said that there would have to be negotiations, there would have to be some form of association. Well, would we like to would the panel like to speculate on the nature of that association, particularly having regard to the suspicions of some, notably the French, that the British and the Italians might find themselves in the position of enjoying some of the benefits of union whilst running very competitive exchange policies outside the monetary union?
It seems to me that your questions were a little bit longer than the first we heard. Well, it's like when you have a Chinese translator. You don't know where... this question is a very important question that has not been addressed up to now in an adequate way. You will have different groups of countries. The first group will be the country joining the monetary union with a lot of problems. A second group will be composed of countries who really want to join, but which are prevented by the fact that they will not meet the needed criterions. And that will probably be the case for Spain and Italy. And then some political move should be made into their direction. Because if they want to join finally the monetary union, in the meantime, they will have some discipline to respect. So they will need to have an announced converging monetary policy, and they will also have to respect some discipline concerning their exchange rates policy. You can imagine, but this probably would be too technical for our debates, you can imagine some automatic constraint for such countries. For instance, the fact that after a certain delay, the help they get from the European institutions will be expressed into their national currency and not into the common currency. And so if they devaluate their currency, what they will get will be the amount expressed in their new national currency instead of having it re-evaluated by the devaluation. So this should be negotiated with such countries. You will have another group, like probably, I don't know if you will succeed in persuading the British to join on time, which will be country very important for Europe, but which decide not to be member of the system. What we'll probably have to imagine is a sort of European monetary system for them. They cannot float freely, and they cannot be members of the single market without some monetary commitment. So the choice will not be between member of the monetary union or nothing. It must be between being member of the monetary union or subscribing some other monetary commitment, probably of the European system type. And this should be studied, and I hope that here in London, some thinking would be devoted on this point.
Do either of you want to make any comment?
It couldn't go straight on. You would have to have a means of adjustment. There was one with the EMS, and I suppose we could learn from that. But in the common agricultural policy at times, we've had to make special arrangements and to cope with different rates of growth and so on. And so we would have to do the same with this. But otherwise, you could turn towards the external tariff and say, very well, the British will have to pay higher tariffs if this is what they're going to do with their currency.
Schmidt?
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Did you all hear the question? No, I mean the questioner is a from the People's Republic of China, and he's also a student at the LSE and the Department of International Relations, and he asked two questions. One, why has the European Union taken so long to negotiate a long-term agreement with the People's Republic? And secondly, how could you have a common foreign policy towards a country such as China where individual nations have such very different relationships? And he cites the difficulties which the United Kingdom is having with reaching a satisfactory relationship with the People's Republic about Hong Kong, and comparing and contrasting that with the long-term successful economic relationships that the German Federal Republic has enjoyed.
Well, the first question I cannot answer. I'm not familiar with the details of British, German, French relations with the People's Republic of China in the long term so far. The second part of the second question was about the relationship between China and the European Union in the future. Once we are establishing a joint foreign policy, which will be done in a process. It will not be done from one Sunday to next Monday. It will take a long time. And it will gradually be established, first this field and then that field and this field. Maybe foreign policy of the European Union vis-à-vis China will not be the last one, maybe one of the first, but once the Hong Kong question is settled, then there is, from a European point of view, still how do we deal with Beijing in regard of Taipei, and then there is the question how do we deal trade-wise with the People's Republic, and I do not see that there is any likelihood that the French Foreign Office or the British or the German Foreign Office, or for that matter the Danish or the Dutch, would differ very much in attitude. I don't see a problem there. The problem that the Chinese foreign policy does have in the main is with the Americans and with the Japanese and with the Vietnamese, not with the Europeans.
Sir Edward?
Yes, I don't think you can say that the European Union has been slow in dealing with the trade problems with China. The differences really are with the Americans, who want to tie up human rights to the question of world trade and Chinese trade. And when the Secretary of State went out there, the Chinese said, thank you very much, we're not interested. So he went away without anything. Then a month later, the Secretary of Commerce goes back and says, forget all about human rights and those sort of things. What I'm interested in is trade. And they say, we like you very much. Here's an order for $5 billion. And that got the thing right. Now, as far as we're concerned, I settled all of this with Chairman Mao Zedong. And we had three things. The first was to stop the shooting across the Hong Kong border, and that stopped at once. The second was a smooth handover of Hong Kong, and all that was going perfectly well until 3 years ago when the new governor made some disastrous decisions, but which are costing us dear. And in 18 months' time, Hong Kong will be handed back to China where it belongs. And I've got absolutely no doubt about it. It's success after all of this, and the Chinese want it to be successful because it can help them enormously with trade and finance and everything else. And the people of Hong Kong are saying, look, for heaven's sake, let's get on with all of this. And the Chinese at the top are saying, well, the British have had Hong Kong for nearly 150 years. They did nothing about democracy. And now they're saying we've got to have a complete democracy in the last 3 years before it becomes part of China. And the last thing is on this question of trade, which has also been mentioned. Now, Chinese trade is increasing at an enormous rate. They've got an enormous favorable balance of payments on all of this. But what is the situation? Japanese, the three of us, myself with Chairman Mao, and then the Japanese Prime Minister a month later, and then President Nixon went halfway, which is as far as he could go at the time because of the Californian mafia. And we all had these agreements, roughly the same time. And Japanese trade now is $32 billion a year. American trade is $22 billion a year. German trade is $8 billion. French trade is $5 billion. And the British are just creeping up towards $3 billion. That's what's happened ever since we had the first agreements with China. And it's our fault. And again, the square, the Hammond Square, was a disaster at the time. But the British are the only ones who keep on going on about it all the time. We can't do this and we can't do that. Remember Tiananmen Square. And this is an aspect which is very damaging to all our world interests and the way we behave in these things. And so I think that we want to do the utmost for China, and we shall get benefits as well as China. But we've got to recognize now that China is a very, very great power on its own.
There are three questioners I want to call before we finish. One, two, three, you, sir.
My name is Alan Mann. I'm a small businessman from Somerset. Distinguished politicians, and three of them are guests here today, have made a political decision that that we should have a common currency in Europe. I don't understand what that is. In my business, I have a dollar account. Many of the companies in Europe deal in dollars. You can take a credit card to many slot machines throughout Europe. You can get sterling or Deutsche Mark or whatever. But my concern is, and Sir Edward put his finger on it completely, that we don't understand how this is going to work. Politicians have made political decisions, but humble people like me who run small businesses, I export and import around the world, we don't know how this is going to work. Maybe Mr. Hurd, Douglas Hurd, perhaps would be a good person to educate us in. How's it going to work?
Oh, I think, Sir Edward, you were calling for a greater educative proposal. Perhaps you could start the process.
It's going to take too long to do here. I agree that there is this feeling that they want to know how it's going to work. And with great respect, the ones I talk to and I hear on the media and so on, are making it much too complicated. Because they say, very well, we should have a common European currency. What happens when it's created? Everybody turns their existing currency into the common currency. That applies all over. And so then they will have the common currency. And then people say, yes, but when we've got the common currency, what rate will the pound and shillings be to the common currency? Which we have to explain that there won't be any pounds and shillings because it'll be a common currency. And therefore these questions, complicated questions, don't arise. And that applies to your business. You'll be very... I saw another accusation today that if we go for this, this is a fellow who used to be in the cabinet, he said, of course, this will put prices up. There's absolutely no truth in this at all. What he is going on was what happened when we went from pounds, shillings and pence into a decimal currency. And we made the mistake, and the only person who pointed it out in Parliament was Ian MacLeod, by going on the pound, because we had 100 decimal places and 240 pence. And the result was it paid everybody to push up that bit, and the inflation went up. New Zealand and Australia were both much cleverer, and they went on the 10 shillings, and they didn't get the inflationary effect. And that's what we've got to deal with this time. And he's quite wrong in saying it automatically means inflation and prices going up.
Monsieur Giscard d'Estaing?
Yes, it's very direct and a practical question. But you give part of the answer yourself. Because why do you use dollar? You could use pound. And if you use dollar, it's because you need to have an international way to communicate in terms of currency. But if you export to France, if you export to Germany, why to use dollar, which is a currency which has a monetary policy on the other side of the Atlantic? No, they don't. No, well, a part of it. Yes, and you have a change of the daily rate of the dollar, which goes up by 10 or down by 15 or 20%, according to factors which are absolutely disconnected with a small business in your county. So what we are trying to do is to have a currency which will be a European currency managed jointly by the European countries and which can perform the service you expect at the moment for the dollar, but which will be based on European realities and economic factors. In the green, what is called the green paper of the open currency, one third is devoted to the question you raise. How to explain to the agents of the economy the interest for them of having a single currency, and if we don't succeed for that, if we don't convince you, the system will fail. So I hope we will not convince you today, of course, but we will live here having reinforced our conviction that this is one of the basic questions we have to solve.
I was looking at papers in Salisbury the other day, and in the 16th century, we used marks. That was our currency. And the other, yeah. And the other thing was...
But there wasn't a Bundesbank.
No, no, no. The Queen's Head only appeared on banknotes in this country in 1948, after the Bank of England was nationalised by the Labour government. The Queen's Head on banknotes is a nasty, Labour, socialistic...
The questioner asked whether Sir Edward Heath would like to defend the criticisms he made to the policy of widening the European Union, particularly to the East, in moral terms, because those countries are undoubtedly those that would benefit most from a union with the West, and it was, after all, in part the actions of the West which led them to find themselves behind the Iron Curtain. Sir Edward.
I don't see how we put them behind the Iron Curtain, but that's a different argument. On a moral question, very well, the answer is that I've already said that we help them in their development to the utmost possible extent. Help them technologically, as we're doing, help them financially, help them educationally, help them administratively. Saying to them, if you wish to join the union, then this is the opportunities which will be open to you if you develop along these lines. And the treaty lays down a constitution which every member has to accept. Now, I find, going back to them, that, of course, a number of them haven't really got hold of how to run a parliament or a democracy or anything like that. That takes time. And again, we help them. We've invited very large numbers over here to our own parliament in order to see if they can develop into a democratic institution. So that's the moral answer, that we are helping them to get into the position where, in due course, if they so wish, they can become a member of the Union. What I'm saying is it's quite unrealistic and very damaging to our position to say, yes, of course, we welcome you with open arms, at any moment this may happen. It can't. One must be quite clear that it's going to take a long time. Otherwise, they're going to be upset and disappointed when in 2 or 3 years' time they don't find their full members of the European Union. So I'm fully covered by the moral argument, and the practical argument will lead to their membership when they find themselves able to do it. I must say that I come across so many instances, even with the most advanced like Hungary, of their difficulties in getting into a democratic system and changing away from 75 years of communist domination in some cases, or 50 years in others. It's a very big change for them. Yes, help them all we can, but don't let's go around saying this is going to happen at any moment and we shall be 28 members or something like that.
You, sir, the last question.
The name is Sack, retired professor of mathematics at the University of Salford, and that's from the staff of Professor Asper. I would like to come back to the question of the common defense force. Such an attempt was made in between the establishment of the iron and steel community and the European economic. There was an attempt made of having a common defense policy, which was thrown out mainly by the French Assembly. Is there any chance of having a better success in the 1990s than it was in the 1950s?
Monsieur Giscard d'Estaing?
Well, I really think so. the attempt, which was called the Communauté Européenne de Défense, CED, was defeated in 1955. It was just 10 years after the war, and the proposal was to integrate the armed force at the level of battalions, and you would have regiments composed of one German battalion, one French, one not British at that time, but Italian, and probably it was too early for the period, because we were very near the war, and the souvenirs or impressions were very alive at that moment. But since then, we did make many moves. For instance, we have the European Corps with Germany, France, Spain, and Belgium, which is doing well at the moment. We have joint procurement for certain armaments between Germany and France, Britain and France, Italy, Britain and France, and all that. So it's underway. And the question is, what will be the proper level for common defense policy? And I guess that either there, it will not be the enlarged Europe, because there's no agreement between the 25 to have a common defense policy. And it will be probably a special group of countries, mostly the Western European countries, probably with Britain, I expect, that will have the will to develop a European defense. And then you have the debate we had a moment ago about the relationship with NATO, which is another question. The question is whether we will pool our defense resources in the future, and my expectation is that we will, between some of the Western European countries, including Britain.
Want to add anything?
No, I would like to agree with what Valérie Giscard said, and I would like to remind people not only of the European Defense Union Treaty being defeated in the French Chamber 40 years ago, but I would also like to remind you of that great speech of John F. Kennedy when he was taking the oath, or a little after, when he talked about a partnership based on two pillars. It's about time that also in the defense field the Europeans create that European pillar. Right now, we are lagging behind. And the fact that we do not have common defense and foreign policy has led to this disaster on the Balkan Peninsula, inside the borders of the former state of Yugoslavia, which was an artificial state created by the victorious powers after World War I. And this is not going to be the last war on the Balkan Peninsula. We're going to see more armed conflicts in the oncoming future there. And if we want, if we want to shelve ourselves against being overrun by events, and they might come not only from the Balkan Peninsula, they might also come from the successor states of the former Soviet Union. We have seen five armed conflicts so far since Gorbachev went on the soil of the former Soviet Union. Chechnya was only the last one, but four others happened before. We might see other ones. Look at the situation between the Russians and the Ukrainians. You look at the risky situation of the three Baltic republics, particularly of Estonia and Latvia. If the Europeans don't get their act together, they will have to depend not on American weaponry, not on American armor, but on American diplomacy. And it's not the wisest that you can find in the world.
It's certainly possible to do this. And the French and the Germans are already doing it between themselves, and doing it successfully. And as far as NATO is concerned, you had it there in the staff and higher commands, and it can be done with the forces. I remember hearing Lord Mountbatten say once, of course, this just wasn't possible, because troops from various countries just couldn't mix. And there was a pause, and then one of the bright people sitting around the table said, did Lord Mountbatten know how many different, how many people from different countries Lord Nelson had in his fleet? Well, Lord Mountbatten didn't. And so his informer said he had 23 people from 23 different countries in his fleet, which was, after all, quite successful at times. And so this can be done. But we mustn't expect the heads of the forces to welcome it. Of course not. They don't like anything like this. And above all, the Navy simply adores this enormous houses and residences and things it has in Washington, and they snuggle alongside the American Navy and all the rest of it. So they've got to be told quite firmly, no, all this is past, and now we're going to have a European unity force, and the governments will decide how it's going to be used.
Well, thank you very much for being such a cooperative audience, and it falls to me now, looking at the clock, to thank our very distinguished visitors on your behalf for what has been, I think, a quite remarkably frank, open, stimulating, informative discussion conducted in what we all agree, sadly, in my view, is our second language, American. I'd be very grateful if, when I lead our guests from the platform, if you could just remain seated so that we can get out in an orderly fashion. But before I do that, I would like to give them all a memento of this occasion, the history of the London School of Economics and Political Science, which, as many of you will know, celebrated its 100th birthday this year. The history is written by one of my predecessors, Ralph Derendorf, another European, and is available at the Economist bookshop.
That's a value offer, isn't it?